this is a series of our ... media conversations. So we've had many throughout the summer. Last week we spoke about cults and deprogramming, which was really a fascinating conversation. We had folks really opening up about what it was like to be in a cult. So we've had some folks really get vulnerable with us, and I'm super excited about today because this topic is near and dear to me. So we just are waiting for Alisa, and then we'll get started. But if you want,
I'm here.
You're here. Oh, great.
I'm next to you. I'm sitting right next to you.
Oh, amazing. I don't know why it's not showing up for me. So great. Perfect. Well, then let's get started. Welcome. So today our conversation is all about something called revenge porn. And this is, this is, as I said, it's something that's super important. And Alisa, if you want to maybe start, we met back in 2015 when I was at CNN. I was at CNN at the time. So for folks in the room, I was our senior technology correspondent at CNN for a decade, and was looking at the issue of revenge porn. And that is how I met, you. And I remember, and this is going to sound weird to folks in the room, but I now call you almost the angel of revenge porn because this is the most horrific type of online harassment. And you are just this woman who comes in and helps people, all women, mainly women all around the world, deal with it. So, can you tell me a little bit, tell us a little bit about your background just to start?
Sure, I will, but I need to sort of disclaim that title. The angels are really the other individuals on with us who have experienced this and really spoken up for everyone. But let me tell you a little bit about sort of how this came to be. I am born and raised in New York, moved down to Miami, and had a practice there until I actually just left to go in-house. So during my time at K&L Gates, I was working with, at the time I was an associate, I was working with a founder, a partner of mine who co-founded the project with me, who is listening and in our room. So hi, Dave. And, at the time, I didn't have any leverage. I was just trying to learn all that I could and be a good associate. And in, not in the shadows, but most of what I was doing on the side was related to women's rights, women lawyers, and, trying to pass it on and pay it forward. I believe truly that lawyers are, practicing laws of privilege, and it's our duty or obligation and really just should be a complete joy and pleasure to help those in need, right? And by that, I mean pro bono work. And so the project started at the end of 2014. It really was a perfect storm because Dave was able to convince the powers that be at the law firm to throw their weight behind this. And the project, the Cyber Civil Rights Legal Project, was born. And the most important piece of it, I think, is that we launched it not as a project for those who couldn't afford the services, which, by the way, are a lot of people, but it was a civil rights project. So meaning that your cyber civil rights are something that are fundamental to our human rights. And so we don't look at it, and the project is still going on. I just don't work at the law firm anymore. But, we didn't ask anyone what they made, what their means were. It's a project for everyone. And we, only had so many resources. I think at our peak, we had 100 lawyers working on 3 different continents or, maybe 4 continents. And, everyone was putting in their time and volunteering for free. And we did as much as we could. And, only have enough resources to do what we can. And there's always, I wish we were out of a job, right? I wish that there was no need for us, but it's still going on even today. And so, that's really that's how we met, was, sort of right after that happened. There was a New York Times article in January of 2015. And then, you and I met and we worked on that amazing project together, which I need to thank you because obviously whenever there's visibility to what, you know, what's going on in this space, whether it's legal work or advocacy work or anything, you know, the media around that really does affect who can see what's happening and who can get help. So yeah, that's really, really critical for us.
Great. Yeah. And then also I'll just mention, Holly, if you don't mind, because you're our only moderator, if you don't mind trying to make Caroline a moderator, me too, so we can invite invite Steph up too really quick. So I think that's just a technical thing, and like Caroline can back channel and tell you how to do that. Yeah, I mean, that, Alicia, I remember that the project we did, I just remember, sitting across from a woman named Nikki, and, you know, who said to us, every time someone Googles my name, I'm worried they've seen me naked. And I just remember thinking, God, that is so astoundingly sad. And this is this type of harassment that at the time no one was talking about, you know? And I think, you know, I think for, and that was back in what, in 2015. And so many things have changed. And I want to get to Jane just to share a little bit of her story. But to start, I think really quick, just so everyone knows the definition, you know, revenge porn, and maybe Alicia, maybe you could give a better definition than me, but it's this idea of having your, it's non-consensual pornography, right? It's having naked photos put out there without your consent. Is that a decent way to describe this?
Yeah, it's fine. It's colloquially revenge porn. It's taken a lot of names, non-consensual pornography or image-based abuse, but essentially your intimate media gets out or is shared without consent. Obviously the two other women, Jane and Holly can really attest to what happened. Yeah.
And Jane, maybe we can start with you. And just so everybody knows, you know, we're calling you Jane Doe. This isn't your real name, and we want to protect your identity.
Yes.
Obviously, the story you're going to tell, I mean, you've had a pretty horrific experience, and we want to be really mindful of that. So can you take me to what happened? I know this was years ago, and we'll get into how you guys met, how you met Alicia, all this kind of stuff. But tell us a little bit about yourself and what happened.
Okay. I was a legal studies student at UCF, and I was working at a law firm, and I met the person who became my boyfriend slash abuser, because to me, you know, the revenge porn in and of itself is a form of abuse. So I'm just going to go ahead and refer to him as my former abuser. But I met him through a networking event, because people in my area, which was personal injury, in his area, which had to do with holistic medicine, kind of worked together. So we met at a networking event and, you know, kind of hit it off, started talking, started dating. A couple of months in, it started to get, you know, abusive, verbally, psychologically, and eventually it kind of like led to physical abuse. And, with that, you know, came the entire, conversation of, you're a goody two shoes. You've never done anything daring, or you're not sexy. Because in the beginning, he would kind of ask me, to allow him to take pictures of me or to send him pictures of myself naked and things like that. But, I had been basically a person at the time who was very religious, grew up in the church. And I barely liked to swear, you know, so, for me, and I had just left, the church at that time and kind of was trying to pursue something for myself and find my own spirituality. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to kind of separate myself from that, but he didn't help, because in a lot of ways he was guilt tripping me and just calling me, you know, you're a Bible thumper, you're this, you're a Jesus freak, and that's why you're not sexy, right? Essentially, telling me, I'm not sexy, I'm not sensual, making me feel like less of a woman. And it was through that type of basically making me feel less than that he was able to convince me, right, or pressure me into allowing him to take photos of me naked, right? And at the time, it was somebody who I thought I loved and somebody who I really wanted his approval. So the more he disapproved of me and the more he made me feel horrible about how I looked, about, he even made me feel bad about wanting to be an attorney and going to school for that. You know, he made me feel horrible about everything about me. So the more he did that, the more I wanted his approval. So I eventually succumbed and allowed him to take pictures of me. But once the other abuses, you know, the psychological, the physical, got extreme for me, I gradually, and we were living together, I guess I failed to mention, we were living together. I started to, little by little, without him noticing, move my things out, you know, because, so this is where it kind of goes into, he used to beat me and, he, one night he tried to kill me with an electric guitar, and we talked briefly about that. Yeah, the neighbors saved my life because I ran outside and he was chasing me and, with a guitar.
I mean, so this is clearly both an emotionally and physically abusive relationship that you are.
Right.
And I think it's important for folks to know. I mean, you talk about, you know, being in a professional field, being someone who you call a goody two shoes, right? Kind of wanting to prove yourself, and you really trusted this person.
I did.
And tell me, and I don't want to interrupt you. I just think that context is really important, because there's so much shaming going on when people see photos of women on the internet or this and that with this type of abuse. So let's go back to that. So you talk about this day where you were actually worried for your life.
Right. And, you know, this was basically the event. And the reason I even go into all of this is to explain why he got angry, right? Because I had tried to leave and he threatened to hurt my family. He threatened to kill my dog, a lot of things. And eventually after that, he beat me that night to where my face was unrecognizable, essentially. Wow. And, I left, and I had already been in the process of moving my things little by little, and I left a lot of things behind in the shared apartment. But after I left was what triggered him to put my pictures online, because he was angry at me, you know, and revenge, you know. So not only did he just put the pictures online, he put my first and last name, my phone number, my email, everything you can imagine.
And can you tell me, I mean, I can't even envision, you know, realizing that, you know, these intimate photos of yourself are online for anyone to see. Can you tell me how you found out or, you know, what went through your head when you saw this?
I remember exactly where I was, what I was doing, and the exact date when I found out. And it was a friend of mine, a male, of course, who messaged me, and he was just like, he messaged me on Facebook, and he was like, look, I don't know if you know, and I don't want to be the one to tell you, but your pictures are online, and what he did on top of putting my pictures on a particular website is he created a fake Facebook and started messaging the pictures to everybody who I knew. Like, and I'm talking about my little brother's friends, because people started contacting me and telling me this, and I appreciated it because they were trying to look out for me, but it was so humiliating. I had never felt so humiliated and defiled in my entire existence, but it was a friend of mine who contacted, he actually sent me the pictures and said, look, there's somebody sending this to me, and I immediately knew who it was, and I emailed him because I had blocked everything of his. I blocked his number. I changed my number. So I was trying to protect myself from him, but I emailed him and he confirmed to me that yes, he put it on some website that I don't remember the name of anymore. So yeah, that's how I found out, through people. People started messaging me and telling me.
I can't imagine sensing an inability to have control, right? When something like that happens, the embarrassment and not being able to control anything. And I think so much of, at least from having covered this, so much of what the folks who do this, they do it. Yes, it's revenge, it's control. It's a very horrific type of harassment.
It is.
And they are, for folks in the audience, like, this isn't just these photos are out there. There are sites, and Lisa, you showed this to me. I mean, there are sites out there devoted to humiliating and shaming women with this type of material, right?
Yeah, and there are a lot of them have been brought down and taken down and offline, but these are, I mean, and you cover this a lot in your, you know, the CNN project that you did, but women are treated like baseball cards, right? Like photos. And sometimes photos are just literally impossible to put back in the box because they are downloaded and shared and downloaded and shared and spread, you know, like wildfire. I remember one of the clients that I was trying to help had been battling the same set of photos for 10 years and literally couldn't make any progress because of how widely they were shared.
Wow. And Holly, I want to talk about your story because you have a fascinating background, and especially with what you've done with a lot of this. But just starting at the beginning, you had a pretty horrific experience that mirrors some of these other stories, is uniquely horrific in its own way. I feel like everybody, it's important to say everybody's story is horrific in their own way. But can you tell us what happened and how this started with you?
Yes, absolutely. And first, I just want to say, Jane, I'm so sorry that this happened to you. And what you went through is horrific. And I'm absolutely here for you as a fellow victim and activist. And I'm somebody who has kind of like put some things in place to hopefully help people like yourself for what
you're
going
through.
Yeah. And so it happened to me in 2012, and I was in the middle of pursuing my PhD. I was actually about to get out of there. I was working on my dissertation, and I posted a picture of me and the person that I was dating at the time on Facebook. And we were at a wedding, so obviously he was my date. Obviously, I was dating him. And the very next day, I got just a flurry of emails letting me know that there was material posted of me on the internet. So there were tons of photos and a video, and just hundreds of posts. I think the first day it was like 200 posts associated with my name. And, you know, some of the people reaching out were, as Jane said, like somebody just alerting you to it and being like, I don't know if you know this, but you should, and you should, you know, get it down, and I can help you do that. But one person in particular was threatening me, and they said, you've seen what material has been posted, and I have more that I could share. And you need to get in touch with me before this time. Otherwise, if you don't, I'll start the distribution. Mm. And I reached out to an attorney that specialized in this area, and he reached out to that individual and told them, you know, basically like, giving them a cease and desist. Like, if you post this, then we're going to come up at you with the fullest force of the law. But that person just ended up following through on their threat. And there were just thousands of search results with my name, you know, and I just found myself a victim of something that I thought only happened to celebrities at the time. You know, I was like, who cares about me? I'm just, you know, a lowly regular person trying to get my degree and trying to get on this professional path that I had built for myself. But I called the police, and I was in Miami, Florida at the time. I called the police and tried to file a report, and they told me, I'm sorry, we can't help you. This isn't illegal. Find yourself a lawyer, hire yourself an attorney. And so I spoke to my attorney, and he was like, you know, I could help you do this, but I see that you're a PhD student. I'm sure you have tons and tons of loans, which I did. And he was like, it'll cost you hundreds of thousands to pursue this person, especially because it's on the internet and all the technological stuff that is involved there of tracing the IP address and whatnot. And in the end, you may not really even get anything, you know, depending on who this person is. And so I, it just, things just kept getting worse and worse. My material was sent to, my family, like my family was alerted of the material. I remember going home for Thanksgiving and my mom received a call, from somebody, just alerting her to the material, and she just, you know, like cursed them out and hung up. There were Facebook accounts made where the account would friend all of my friends, and then once it had friended, you know, a couple hundred or so, then they would post the material. And
I don't mean to interrupt, only to say,
no, it's fine.
And I think you and Jane both, you speak about this, right? As you I feel like this is something you have lived with, right? But listening to this, it is so extraordinarily enraging and scary. And I cannot even imagine that feeling. I mean, how did you cope with it at the time?
For Holly?
For either of you. I mean, Jane, go ahead.
Go ahead, Holly. Go ahead, Holly.
For me, I just kept moving forward. Like, I just kept thinking, you know what? The worst that it gets, eventually, like, somebody has got to pick up my case. And the worst that it gets, the more documentation I have of how bad it is, and it's going to be that much stronger of a case. Because human resources at my school, at my university, was alerted to this information. And because some of the postings were titled so-and-so masturbates for her students, since I had taught some classes at some point in time, then they started to worry that I was some kind of sexual predator. So I had to go in there and defend myself. And Human Resources was like, well, if it's, and I told them, I was like, I am not doing this. I am being targeted by someone who is trying to destroy my life. And Human Resources was like, well, if it's not you doing this, then why don't you just change your name? You know, why don't you just do that? And so you can separate yourself from this material. Like, it's that easy. And eventually I did, because I reached a point where I was like, all right, you know what? I guess I'm going to change my name if I have any hope of making some sort of life for myself after this.
I mean, the idea that you had to change your name and defend yourself from, you know, from being called a sexual predator.
It was just really like a whole other layer, you know. It started to just, I started to really lose it and have like, you know, suicidal thoughts. And I never... it's just like, it was terrifying that the thoughts actually came to me. I don't think I could have ever gone through with it, but I just had reached a point where I was like knocked down so far that I was like, what do I have to live for? You know,
God, like thinking, I can't even imagine feeling so, so low that you feel like death is an option out. I can't even envision that feeling. And I'm so sorry for that feeling. Jane, I'm curious for you. I know we hear Holly talk a little bit about how she was coping at the time. How did you cope at the time?
At first it was actually listening to her story. So many things hit home. But Holly, I'm so sorry to hear that seeped into your professional I can't even imagine, you know, so I'm so sorry. But I had suicidal thoughts as well. And I remember, much like her, finding out that there wasn't much support in the law for us, you know, so I remember thinking maybe I should kill myself, because maybe if that happens, maybe they'll pay attention to this issue. I remember literally thinking maybe my only purpose after this is to maybe get people to change the law, right? But luckily I had friends. You know, I did not tell my family, which is another thing. I was so embarrassed. I was too embarrassed to ask for help. And the lawyers that I did talk to was kind of a similar thing. I was a student at the time. I was finishing up my degree, and I couldn't afford to pay, you know, an attorney. So basically I compartmentalized and tried to push it out of my mind and not think about it, you know. So the way that it even came to my mom's attention was like a couple of years later, because, by the way, those pictures were still circulating because I felt so powerless. I just was like, I'm just gonna act like it didn't happen and change my number. And because I was getting harassed too, because he put my phone number, he put my name, my pictures, my information on a sugar baby website. Like I was looking for a sugar daddy. I didn't even know what a sugar baby was at that time. Because like I mentioned earlier, I had been very sheltered. So I found out what a sugar baby was. And I had people calling me in the middle of the night, you know, and I had people contacting me and telling me, maybe you should work in pornography. You know, maybe this is what you could be doing. Why don't you come work for me? And it was just horrifying. So I changed my phone number. And that's it, you know, and I thought about changing my name as well, but I just didn't have the resources to do it. So a couple years later, it resurfaced because somebody called my mom, told her about it, and she confronted me. And that's when her and my boyfriend found Elisa, you know, and that's how I met Elisa. But I never truly coped with it. I simply ran away from it, in a sense.
Yeah. And when it comes, so one of the through lines here, by the way, every woman on the stage, our through line here is Elisa, right? Like, we are all connected through Elisa.
Which makes me very lucky.
Which makes all of us, I think, very
lucky.
You are someone who fights against the bad guys, in such an extraordinary way. Like I love to watch your work. I love to cover your work. It's been a privilege of my career. And also I will say it's been a privilege to speak to women like you guys who speak about these things and have the courage to speak about these things, because I can't even imagine. I know I've said that a lot on this, but I just can't even imagine, the pain that's associated with it. And so, Elisa, I want to talk to you about how, first of all, how you got involved, how everybody on the stage found you.
It's a good sort of circling back, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually,
could I
interject a little bit? Because
yeah.
I feel like the story of how Elisa gets involved is how I... ended up coping. Once I hit like complete rock bottom, I was like, all right, well, you know what? Nobody's doing anything about this. You know, nobody, I see that there are victims. There are thousands of victims on these sites where I am. And nobody is coming forward and talking about this. There's obviously people going through it. So why don't I speak out about it? And at first it started off through a website, and I decided what really needs to happen is we need a federal law against this. And so I drew up a drafted law I put my PhD to use in my real life, and I researched laws and I drafted what I thought would be a good law against this. And then I collected signatures. And then through that, I started, it was kind of like a lighthouse. Like I put up this beam, and then all of these experts that were working on this issue that were quietly kind of writing about it in research and in law started reaching out to me. And, and saying, hey, I want to help. And eventually I launched a nonprofit organization called the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, where I built it to be a resource for any victims out there. So anybody who needed to get their material down, we had advice on that. Anybody who needed to be put in touch with pro bono attorneys, we started collecting information of attorneys that were willing to take on cases pro bono. I did some survey research on it so that we could collect data about it. And then eventually we started working with legislators throughout the United States and the world, really, to legislate against this issue. So when I started Cyber Civil Rights Initiative in 2013, there were only like 3 laws. And now there are 48 in Guam and D.C., and federal legislation has passed the House. So it was like kind of through CCRI, actually, that I met Elisa. It was one of my like right-hand women, Professor Marianne Franks, who is just a force. Oh my gosh, she's just amazing. She's a law professor, and she helped kind of draft some of the legislation all around the U.S. And I believe that Elisa met Marianne at a luncheon, right, Elisa? And then they were talking about CCRI, and Elisa was like, I want to get involved. Like, I have this idea for our project, and I want to help.
Yeah, and part
Did
of
I tee that up right?
Right.
That was good. It.
And it's also part of your healing, right? And part of your being able
yes.
to cope with the idea that these images of you were all around. And but it sounds like part of what you saw is, and I remember even seeing this in 2015 when we started covering this for CNN. I just remember being like, God, this is such a huge issue. Like, why aren't we talking about this enough? Like, why haven't the tech companies done anything? Why are lawmakers like acting like they've never heard of this? Like, this is
right.
horrific. And it sounds like, you know, you took that pain and you took that trauma and tried to make real legal change. So
yeah.
That's the tee up to Elisa. So Elisa, tell us about your meeting with Holly, and also I'm curious to know. So what does the law say, and where are we at?
Ah, so many good things to talk about. So let me start from where Holly teed it up, and agree that Marianne Franks is absolutely amazing. At the time that I met her, Florida had tried once to pass a law, and it didn't go through. And so this was the sort of second go around. So first of all, I threw some weight behind that, and we started to work with the state attorney's office to try and see if we could get to Tallahassee and get a law passed. And while I was thinking about that, I was thinking also about the fact that there's sort of two. When I looked at someone who's struggling with this, and of course, you know, all of the emotional impact of it, you know, but I'm thinking about remedies, right? I'm not the person, although I will talk to everyone, I'm not the person to solve those problems. I'm looking at it from a legal perspective. There's the taking down of photos, the removals from the internet, or, you know, destruction for if someone else has copies of it. And that's good and well, and a law would be wonderful, but it's not going to be retroactive, right? A law is not going to help the people who either, you know, can't get the photos down or, you know, don't have any means to figure out who did it, right? And as I think we've heard today, if you're not able to find the root cause of it, it can often, this abuse and this trauma can just go on and on and on without an end. So that's when the law firm came into mind. And, you know, we, that firm has a cyber forensics lab internal to it, and forensic investigators and technologists. And so part of what we were able to do was use our capabilities. And again, this is K&L Gates, you know, giving them all the credit for it. We were able to use our capabilities to help individuals identify and de-anonymize anonymous individuals who were threatening, you know, the Janes and Hollies of the world. And so I always said, we're not hoarding all of the revenge porn victims by any means. I would be happy if any lawyer, you know, called me and wanted help walking through a case, and I've done that many, many times. But without the forensic capabilities, it becomes expensive. And, you know, we've in some really extreme cases, we've had third-party forensic firms support us and do the work pro bono as well. And it's, I mean, it's incredible how much material came out of it and was utilized. So, you know, there's, I think, the removing of materials, which often, you know, one of the first questions I ask individuals is, and probably, Holly asked you this, is what do you want, right? Some people want to find out who it is, stop them, you know, full force, go ahead. Some people just want the material down, you know, so they can go on, and some people just want to crawl into a hole and, you know, and make it go away. So I can't talk about the specific conversations that Holly and I had, but I can say that it was an interesting, certainly an interesting way to meet someone, and credit to, you know, both Holly and Jane and all of the individuals who seek help, because, you know, remember, the sort of main thing that's happening here is exposure. And it's not only, you know, yes, it's the intimate photos and, you know, your most private moments. You know, sometimes the videos and photos were taken consensually, but sometimes they were taken without knowledge. Okay. And that's what happened, if you remember, with Nikki, right? She didn't even know this was being taken. I think he had put one in the bathroom. It was just horrific.
Yeah. To give folks in the room, I'll explain, to give folks in the room some context. So Elisa and I met when we were working on a story. We were doing a special for CNN called Revenge Porn, The War on Women. And Elisa introduced us to a woman named Nikki, who to this day is probably one of people always ask me, because I've interviewed a lot of tech founders. Sorry if any tech founders are in this room and I've interviewed you. But, you know, people always say, who's your favorite interview? And I think Nikki might be one of my favorite people I've ever interviewed. This woman had her photos put out there. You know, she reminds me, Holly and Jane, of you guys, right? It was just extraordinary, you know, the pain she had been through. She had a boyfriend who we all nicknamed at the time Mr. Wonderful. Is that right? In a sarcastic way,
right.
Obviously.
Yeah.
We called him Mr. Wonderful. She called him Mr. Wonderful, so we called him that. And he had recorded her without her knowing, and I think in like a pen cap or something, put it in her room and recorded her, and he put her images everywhere. And I remember, and this kind of goes into, Elisa, some of these legal issues. I remember, and this is a little kind of reporting thing too. Sometimes when someone just says something to you in a sentence, it just, when you're talking to a source or you're talking to an interviewee, it just takes you on a whole new road. And I'll never forget, it was me and my producer, Erica, who were sitting there with you in Nikki's home, and we were looking at this horrific site that Mr. Wonderful had posted Nikki's images in.
I remember
and
that.
And you said this thing that like created a whole new story for us. You said, you know, and it's so crazy because, you know, with the copyright, in order to own the copyright and so she can take this down, you know, you have to send your like naked photo, or you have to like send a naked photo or whatever to like copyright office, something like that. And I remember Eric and I were like, wait a second, you have to send naked photos to the government if you're a victim of revenge porn to protect yourself? And it just felt like all of this felt so messed up. And I remember it wasn't long after that that we were sitting in the CNN newsroom, and we were undercover, and I was calling up the copyright office, and one party consent, so we were allowed to do this. This was all based on what you said. And I was saying, if I'm a victim of revenge porn, you know, and do I need to send you my naked photos? And it was just this, you just begin to see, and the woman was like, yeah, you've got to send, you know, in order to get the copyright, in order to take them down, you need to send us your naked photos. And I was like, I don't want it to go to some old dudes at the copyright office. Like, I remember we taped it all. And it was just,
oh my goodness.
It was just this extraordinary moment, though, which I'm sure Holly, Jane, Elisa, you guys see. Like, it was just like, it felt like the law was just so, it just felt so unfair, you know, all
yeah.
of that. Like, if I
yeah.
were actually a victim of revenge porn, having to get the copyright to these images so we could get them taken down, and Elisa, I'll have you explain that, by
sure.
sending my naked photos to some likely old dudes at the copyright office, it didn't feel okay. And I remember the president of CNN walked by at the time. He was like, what are you girls up to? I was like, don't even ask. It was extraordinary. So can you explain that? Because it kind of helps you understand a little bit more about how the law works and how you've been able to get things taken down.
Sure. So I do remember all of that. And Lori, if you sat with every single person, because it's men too that I help, I swear you wouldn't have no more time left in your days, just because the stories are all, each in their own way, just absolutely extraordinary. And I and Jane and Holly, I've worked with both of you, and you're so brave. I mean, and I'll get to copyright in a second, but when I was talking about exposure, it's not just the intimate photos, it's also these abusers and these perpetrators attached to it all of the information possible about you, your name, your address, your school, where you teach, where you work, your handles, in this way that you just become so very exposed, right? If photos were out there and no one knew who it was, that's one thing, but it's just, and I saw a meme once about how to create the maximum amount of damage, and it's always stuck with me and horrified me. So, that's what we're dealing with. Now, in order to take material off the internet, we don't need to copyright the material. So I want to make sure that people understand that. And the way to remove it is under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA. You can send a request to remove copyrighted information or information that you own the copyrights in from any website or platform. So, for example, Lori, if we go out for manicures and martinis together, and you take a photo of the two of us and, somehow that gets somewhere where you don't want it to be online, you can submit yourself. You don't have to hire a lawyer, although I'll do it for you if you need help. And you can submit a request to pull that down. And generally, websites and platforms are all very responsive to these requests, because if they don't respond, there are consequences where they can lose their safe harbor and protection from liability. Now, copyrighting materials is a prerequisite to filing a federal copyright lawsuit. So in some cases, and this was the case that was actually reported by the New York Times, but this lawsuit that was filed was a copyright lawsuit in federal court alleging violation of copyrighted materials, which included photos and videos. And yes, in order to copyright materials, you need to send them in. There is a waiver process in order where you can request to not have to send the materials in. But we only even learned about that sort of halfway through what we were doing. And I think the norm is to just submit. And in a lot of cases, I've known individuals to just submit because it's easier and, they want to sort of get the process through. But the damages for a copyright violation can be massive. Again, it really depends on what everyone wants, what the victim wants out of the situation. And that's what, I as a lawyer would do. And sometimes it's, people often ask me, like, how do you sleep at night? And I sleep very well. When when my head hits the pillow, I'm out. But, a lot of times I get so fired up about what's happening. And, my desire would be to, like, stab this person, right? To actually find them, hunt them down, and pursue them until they're finished. But a lot of times victims just want the materials down or, want something different. And so my job is to advocate on behalf of the client and to make sure they're getting what they want. And so I think one of the first questions that often people, I think, forget to ask is what do you want? And a lot of times, victims don't know, but, certainly when you have someone who's sending photos to your, nieces and nephews, your students, imagine the people. I mean, if everyone takes a moment and thinks of, who would you not want to see the photos most and that happening? I mean, that's what we're talking about. It's really just mind-boggling to this day.
Jane, when you met Lisa, when you got in touch with her, what did you want? Obviously you wanted this to disappear, to go away. What was the biggest thing for you?
At that point in time, I just, once my mom found out about it, that was my ultimate nightmare, because my thing was a couple of years prior to that, everybody had seen it. My little brother's friends, my friends, my friend's friends, you know, everybody except for my parents. So the way that I was kind of able to move on in a way and was just like, okay, so my parents don't know about this and they're not likely to because they don't get online like that, you know. But guess what? That's not how it works. So somebody anonymously contacted my mom and told her about it. So my biggest nightmare was my mom finding out. And basically all I wanted was those pictures to go away, right? I hadn't thought about anything beyond that. And of course, I was in a pretty difficult situation. In trouble because of something that he had convinced me to do. So I was in a pretty limited situation. So basically all I wanted was for the pictures to go away. But now I feel like if it was me now, I would definitely want to go after him as hard as I could, because he didn't only, not that only doing that isn't the worst thing that's ever happened to me, but on top of that, you know, he physically hurt me. He psychologically hurt me. To this day, I've never been the same person since. I had nightmares about this, and I still do to this day. And this was 8-9 years ago, and I still have nightmares about it. I still have difficulties in my current relationship. I still don't make friends, you know, and I was talking to Caroline about it. I don't make friends. I don't trust people. So it's now, if I could, I would definitely want to go after him so he could just pay for what he did, because this should be criminalized, in my opinion. This is a sex offense, you know? So that's where I was at the time. Just get these pictures down, you know?
Yeah. What do you feel like he took from you?
My, just with the leaking of the pictures, for example, my pride, my confidence, my respect, my dignity, I cannot compare to how a rape victim feels, but I feel like this is the closest that I can get to empathizing with that, because I felt so violated, and not by one person, thousands, right? And people who would contact me to gloat about the fact that they were having their fun with my pictures, I did not want every single person to see my body. It was somebody who I thought I loved, so I felt betrayed too. So there's just so much that was taken away, and I don't think I will never be the same person that I was, you know. That is the truth. So I just hope that if there's anybody listening in this situation, or not even in this situation, but sees certain red flags, please heed those red flags, because somebody who loves you is not gonna guilt you or tease you or make fun of you into doing something you're not comfortable with, you know?
Yeah. And Holly, I'd love for you to jump in. I know that what you've built, you know, I'm sure that you guys get, I mean, how many people message you guys every month, or what are the statistics of people reaching out for help now compared to what it was years ago? And I know you're not involved as much on a day-to-day basis, but how are you doing now?
Right. So we have a helpline that victims can call into, and the number is 844-878-2275. I think it's 2275, it's CCRI, and I forgot what the numbers were. But through that helpline in 2020, we helped over 4,000 victims. In 2021, from January through June, just January through June, we helped 2,056. So if we continue on the current pace, then we'll be just about like 30 individuals less than 2020. We still get lots of calls, and I was at the helm of CCRI for 5 years. I was the executive director. So I was running the organization, but I was also doing interviews like these all the time and hashing back through my story and retelling it to the point that I really, I kind of don't even connect with it anymore on an emotional right. level. But it wears on me. It really does. Like we spoke this morning, right? And I told you, I was like, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about it.
Yeah.
But when you're a victim of this, every single detail seems so important, and like you can't leave it out and you have to share your story. And then, after I spoke with you, I just felt like a floating head for the day, and I just needed it's music. I play music. I listen to music. So I had to like play music to just bring myself back down to earth. So because of that, I'm still a board member for the organization, but I have very much taken a step back from doing the day to day, like reading the news and, telling my story and everything, just because it just wears on you. And most victims of this have developed PTSD and depression and anxiety. And, I am no exception. It has definitely taken a toll on my psyche. And, but I still just, I want to do, you know, good in this world for whatever reason, whether it's genetic or, I don't know. I grew up in a very like caretaking family because my oldest brother is handicapped with cerebral palsy, and it feels good to get out there and help however I can, like help make the world a better place. So I guess that's why I kind of chose the path that I did. But my heart absolutely breaks for Jane, hearing her say that, you know, she doesn't make friends. Like, I want to be your friend. I want to be here for you. And I completely understand, you know, not being able to trust after this.
Thank you. I appreciate
really, it. Yeah, of course.
I was hoping I wasn't going to cry, but of course it's hard.
It's okay. This is something just horrible that destroys every aspect of your life. And, I've done a lot to put myself back together, but I definitely still struggle. And sorry, I didn't know that I would cry.
It's kind of, I thought I was doing so good. I was like, I didn't cry this time.
You guys are both doing amazingly, and I know it's been a number of years for you both, but just, you know, to those of you who are listening and really haven't had an experience like this or known someone, you know, seeking help and speaking out about this and even getting help is, you know, is experiencing the trauma over and over again, right? And so, you know, when Holly and I sat down for the first time, she had to show me, you know, I had to see everything, all of the materials and all of the messages and all of the emails and just literally everything. She had to pour herself, you know, out in front of me. And then, you know, with a litigation, you know, if you're really trying to seek justice against someone, you get deposed and people get to ask you questions, and then there's written questions. And it was, so it's telling your story. And then there, you know, there could be testimony that in court, I mean, it's a process. And so, you know, in particular, Jane, I know you said, you know, if you could do it over again, you'd do this, you know, maybe not. And you know, I'm always here for you. I have a feeling that you and Holly will stay connected. But
I hope,
you
know, so.
Both of both of you, I'm sure, have made at least this room a better place. And you know, if I always say, if I spend my time talking about this and one person hears and then is able to seek help or, you know, help a friend or at least if they see some pictures, I mean, I have got three boys and the, you know, one is more tech savvy than the other one. My 3-year-old can sync up like 5 devices and play Pac-Man on all of them at the same time. But, you know, I have frank conversations. If you see this material, if you see this happen,
don't spread it, don't save it, don't share it, tell people to stop, you know, put a hold on it, let the person know. You know, the quicker you're able to take action, you know, the quicker you can at least attempt to put it back in. But, you know, we have to be upstanders and not bystanders. You know, don't let this stuff happen. One of Karen, who's in the room, Karen Guggenheim, is the founder of WHASI, which is the World Happiness Summit. And, you know, part of what she and I have been collaborating on, because now that I'm not, by the way, at the project anymore, I have to find other ways to sort of scratch this itch. But we're working on, education, the educational component, teaching how to be a safe internet user and a good digital citizen in schools, and how to make sure people maintain their sense of worth and wellness and all of that. So I think that there's more that we can do. There's always more we can do. It's not just attorneys, Lori, it's you. I mean, all of the resources and the attention that you've given this is extraordinary. And I'm sure that you have contributed to helping people. And it's just, it's really great to see, Jane, I know it's hard for you, and Holly, I know it's hard for you as well, but, you know, you speaking out is definitely changing someone's life for the better. So thank you for being here and you know, pouring yourself out again. Yet one more time.
Thank you.
I'm always really mindful, Jane and Holly, as a journalist, right, that we step into people's lives and then we step out, right? We don't mm-hmm. have to live every single day with that pain. And so I always try to remember that when I walk into people's, the worst day of someone's life, right? And that's happened at a couple times in my career. And this is why I think a topic like this, I always promise myself that as I walk away, I'll never shut the door on it, on something as important, in order to honor the people that I interview and that really put themselves out there to do something that, God, I don't even know if I'd be able to do truly. It's really scary. I always promise myself that, you know, I will continue covering this. And so, I hear that it's emotional, and I really appreciate you guys. I know you talk about the idea that even talking about these things brings up there's PTSD associated with it. So, I really do hope that that Holly and Jane, that you guys are able to connect. And Jane, too, it breaks my heart to hear you say that about not trusting people. I'm sure Holly can really empathize with that. So I just really thank you guys for coming up here and kind of putting this, putting yourselves out there like this. It really is pretty extraordinary.
Thank you for covering this, and thank you, Elisa. You don't even know the impact you've had in my life. I can't even put it in words, but I want to thank you both because, you, Lori, for covering this and using your platform to address it. That's one of the things that made me kind of put on a brave face and want to talk about this because I was super nervous, but I know that it can help somebody. So thank you, and thank you, Elise.
Holly, I want to give you the opportunity because you actually have gone to tech companies and you have, as part of what you've done, you've advised them on how to treat harassment on their platforms. I have sat with founders of different platforms, emerging platforms, platforms that have been out there for a long time, and as they've, gone through highs and lows. As someone who has personally experienced the horror that can happen when it comes to harassment on a platform, and as someone who talks to different founders, what would you say to the founders here about treating harassment?
I would say just be aware of it. There's actually a really, really good documentary called The Social Dilemma on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And they address, the things that social media is doing and how it's ruining our lives. Just watching things like that and just being mindful of how the tech can be used to harm. Like you think, okay, you're building this great platform where you can connect all these people and everything. Think about the bad actors and what they can do with it. And always keep that in mind whenever you're building any aspect of the platform. you know, the algorithms and the make sure that you have certain policies and procedures in place to help people who might be victimized on the platforms. And CCRI, we actually help and consult with companies on that. So feel free to reach out. It's cybercivilrights.org, and we'll help you. And then, you know, we just ask that you give us a tax-free donation in return to help us keep doing the work that we're doing.
Any, and I know that sounds like a good resource for folks who are going to, but I don't want to leave this conversation without resources for folks or anyone who's going through something. So Alisa or Holly or Jane or anything, are there any resources that you would suggest for folks
absolutely
going through this?
Absolutely. So, you know, as Holly mentioned, the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative is a national advocacy group. That's cybercivilrights.org. You will be able to find your way to the Cyber Civil Rights Legal Project from that website, but it's separate. That's the project that's run by K&L Gates. And any individual can write in on the form to seek legal advice if they are a victim of non-consensual pornography. And that website is cyberrightsproject.com. The other thing, and Holly mentioned this, there are a number of advocates in this space and brilliant legal minds, and other non-legal folks. If you're a Twitter person, I would recommend, following them. There's always content, stories, decisions, you know, things being, pushed out. So, and I'll probably forget someone, so sorry, but, no, absolutely, Holly, Marianne Franks, Danielle Citron, Ari Waldman, Carrie Goldberg, Lori Siegel. Who else am I forgetting? But, right, there are a number of, you know, a lot of women who are you know, trailblazing in this space. And, you know, I think, again, huge kudos to, obviously, the two heroes or angels on the call, and then Lori, you for putting this out there, because you are the most wonderful interviewer, and I've heard you interview, you know, probably almost everyone, but you don't, like, you leave the room, but you don't leave these issues alone, right? This is, I mean, how many years later are we still talking about this? And you can see there's still work to be done. So, it's just...
Well, I appreciate that, and I would say the key to being a great interviewer is just really find great subjects, and sit back and listen. So I really appreciate that, and I think you're right. I mean, when we look at the future of revenge porn, we are entering a world, and I think it's really important for everyone to understand this, like, we're entering the world of deep fakes, we are entering the world of VR, and where we're going to have weird questions about virtual consent. Like, we are entering a new era. And so we've got to really have these discussions and talk to our tech folks about this, talk to lawmakers about this, because I think Holly and Jane, you do such a brilliant job of really talking about the human impact of this type of harassment. And I think we'll all keep fighting for this. And I want to, you know, I know we have to end, and I really want to be mindful, because I know this stuff, it's really hard. I asked this question to Nikki, who is the woman that I interviewed, and I want to kind of end on this question. I asked her the same question years ago, and so I'd like to give you guys the opportunity, and tell me if you don't want to answer it. I'm totally down. I don't, you know, it's totally up to you. But what would you, Holly and Jane, what would you say to the man if you were sitting across from him? What would you say to the man who did this to you?
I've never thought about that. I don't think I'd say anything. I have nothing. Yeah. I cannot even, I wouldn't say anything.
Yeah. I would just want to punch the hell out of him. Honestly.
Yeah, that
but,
too.
but also I would just say, like, how small are you that you had to do something like this to make yourself feel like bigger? and big enough to live in this world. And like, how dare you? Like, you have no right. And I mean, I feel like there are so many things that I would say, but it's just, it's hard. It's a good question, but it's like a loaded question for a victim because.
It's a great question.
I think what's extraordinary is what's happened with you has launched a campaign for women and protection all around the world. So, you know, I know there are probably so many people that can't thank you, right, for setting up these initiatives, at least the same thing. And Jane, it's so powerful to hear your voice and hear you speak. And you guys all have my cell and my email, and you just, you know, I'm only a call away. And I know Elisa feels the same. So thank you guys all, so much. Is there anything you guys want to add before we dip out?
I just want to fix the number that I said was the helpline.
Okay. Sure. Please.
It's 844-878-2274. But you can find that on the cybercivilrights.org website, and also follow CCR Initiative on Twitter, because we are constantly posting about any new developments in this area. And thank you. Thank you so much, Lori and Elisa. I mean, I'm going to see you in like a few days.
I know. I can't wait
to hug you. But you have no idea how much you saved me. You know, I was telling Lori earlier, I went through so many attorneys and was so skeptical when I first met you. And I didn't know that part. Okay.
We can talk about it over
martinis. Yeah. But you truly, truly saved my life and helped me get back on like a professional path that I had worked so hard to get on. And Lori, thank you so much for continuing to cover this issue. It's a shame that it still has to be covered, but you do such a wonderful job.
Thank you. And Jane, I'll leave you with the last word. I know you wanted to, it sounded like you wanted to say something.
Just two things. The first thing is, for anybody listening, if anybody is in an abusive relationship, do not stay. If you see the signs, if you see the red flags, and just remember that love is not something that's gonna pressure you to do anything. And, the second thing is, if something like this happens to you, don't blame yourself. Don't blame the fact that you allowed or didn't allow or whatever you did as far as pictures go, because there's a lot of that going on. So that's all.
Beautifully said. You are not alone.
Guys, ladies, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you guys so much for joining us. We're going to be back next Tuesday at 6 p.m. So thank you, everyone. I know this one wasn't easy, and so I'm sending you virtual hugs. If I could send them through Clubhouse, I would. Thank you again, and thank you for everything you're doing for victims all around the world.